CinemaSins has a fan club. It's called the Sin Club, and members get all sorts of things like early episodes, bonus videos, merch discounts, and even monthly bonus podcasts. Membership starts at $3 a month, and you can sign up now at patreon.com/CinemaSins.
Good. I wanted you to cry.
Oh, my God. I knew it. As soon as I was doing it, I was like, oh, yeah, he wants this.
Yeah.
Welcome to SinCast, presented by CinemaSins.
All right, everybody, welcome to the SinCast. This is Chris Atkinson from CinemaSins, joined by Barrett Sher.
Hello.
And Jonathan Watkins.
Hello, hello.
Today we have a very special guest. It's writer-director David Frain, who has done a movie called Dating Amber. Welcome to the show, Dave.
Thank you very much. And actually, I should stress it's coming out now on November the 10th.
All right, November 10th it is. This movie is about a gay teen in what we would call high school. Is that what you would call it out there? What do you call it out there?
We call it secondary school.
Secondary school. Okay. So it's a gay teen in secondary school who finds a lesbian friend to pretend date so that they can cover their sexuality to everybody else and put on this sort of show for everyone, basically. How much of this movie is autobiographical?
Kind of a tragically large amount of it is autobiographical.
Oh, no.
So I grew up where the film's set, just outside Dublin in Ireland. And I grew up kind of around the time of the film a little bit later, which is set in the 90s. And yeah, I really struggled, like a lot of people, coming to terms with my sexuality. And I had a friend in school who later turned out to be a lesbian. And it was in hindsight, we thought, God, our lives would have been so much easier if we just pretended to go out for a year or two. And that was where the idea of the film came from. But a lot of the really embarrassing things that happened in the film, a lot of the, the big struggling scenes with my family, they're all kind of 100% truthful. So it's as truthful as I think I'll ever get on film.
Yeah. That was another question I had, was that the family dynamic in this is really interesting. It's also like very frank. I don't know how frank it gets. Every time I see this in an American film, I'm like, oh, they're just doing that for fun. The families don't talk to each other like this.
Yeah.
But did your family or do families in general talk like this in Ireland?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think Irish people, we do swear a lot, which I'm kind of used to tempering now when I talk to, Americans or English, but we swear a lot and we can be quite, it's kind of like, it's a nice mixture of extremely pent up and repressed and quite frank. I think it's kind of the best description of Ireland. I think a lot of the stuff in this is very true, very true. A lot of the conversations are true to life. I mean, even there's a very bizarre sex ed video in this run by a nun.
Oh my God.
But that's like based on a real video.
That was one of my questions. Yeah. I had to know if that was real.
Yeah. It's kind of like, it's too bizarre to be real, but it was real. It was made in the 90s or in the 80s, but they still played it. So I watched the real version in the 90s when I was kind of, I think I was about 12 when I was shown it. And it is like all the really bizarre things are true to life. It's kind of like Ireland is very bizarre in many ways. And I think very often the most absurd stuff is realistic in life anywhere. But families are pretty frank, and nuns give sex ed. That's Ireland.
They're drinking tea right as they're in mid-coitus.
That was sort of what I was thinking. Like there's sort of a reality, like exaggeration wheel where like you look at it and it's like, man, this is so exaggerated. But then I was thinking to myself, this might actually be real. I've seen videos like this that are just that people think they're helping and they're just being insane during it.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I always find, I think very often for me, comedy is the most truthful because those absurd moments do just ring so honestly and true to life. You know, I often find it like an Armandian Yuchi type thing. It, like the Veep is more honest than, say, the West Wing. You know, it's a more honest like kind of
right
view of politics would be. And I think with this, you know, rather than those kind of, yeah, as much as I love many of them, but those kind of quite po-faced, dour coming out stories, they didn't reflect my experience. My experience was very tragic and very funny and very cringeworthy. And I think that's kind of what I wanted to bring to the screen.
Yeah, during the logos of this movie, there's a smattering of audio where I was wondering if that was sort of the summary of what you were hearing back in the 90s about gay life and everything. Is that sort of true?
Yeah, I mean, it's at the time, absolutely. I think, you know, and you know, even when you're watching sitcoms at the time, whether they be American or English, there was so much kind of passive homophobia in them. And then in Ireland, you know, it was only in 1993 that Ireland decriminalized homosexuality. So, you know, it wasn't where I grew up kind of being taboo. You grew up being criminal. And I think that was a big legacy for a lot of my generation going into adulthood, was just, you know, coming from this extremely Catholic country that had not yet begun to liberalize, really. I think this film is set at the beginning of what would be the liberalization of Ireland. So yeah, I mean, I think a lot of that stuff, you know, growing up with those AIDS ads and those really tragic kind of representations of being gay were your only touchstone for gay people. And it was never a funny or happy representation. And I think that does inform how you experience the world around you at that time. But, you know, I think what I found really interesting is, even though I set this, you know, because I love the 90s and it was kind of nostalgic for me, I was really struck by how much my younger cast, many of them who were still in school, how much they kind of responded to the film and how much of their own experiences rang true to what was going on in the film. I think, you know, kids, I don't think kids learn like morality until they're about 18, and they're generally just, can I say arseholes? They're arseholes.
Yes, you can say whatever you like.
Well, I said it twice. So their kids are just innately quite mean, and you know, when they're being funny, and they don't often know the hurt they're causing. But I think if you're struggling with your identity, the stuff that happens around you can have a massive impact. And I think that's what both Eddie and Amber in the film are going through, is, you know, they're just kind of surrounded by this passive onslaught of kind of toxic masculinity and kind of homophobia and just general crap.
And it's really encapsulated in several moments, but one just tiny moment where Amber says, "This is the longest I have been. It's been since I've been called a lesbian." Except for after a tragic event happened. She doesn't seem like somebody whom that would affect all that much, but you can tell that it does. Just something like that over and over and over. It's death by a thousand cuts.
Yeah.
And this relationship has saved her just the grief of constantly getting that. It's just really amazing how you can encapsulate that in such a tiny moment in time.
Absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, that kind of constant onslaught just affects you. It doesn't matter how confident you think you are. And obviously in this film, you know, Amber, played brilliantly by Lola Pettigrew, she's, you know, the more confident person. I mean, she's kind of definitely more at ease with being queer. She just can't ever consider being queer where she grew up, and she wants to escape. And it's the opposite for Eddie, who just can't consider being queer, full stop. Even for her, I think it's just you need a break, you need a reprieve, and that's what this relationship gives them. And then it gives them so much more. They end up forming this great first love. I mean, it's a love story for me, albeit platonic. They are each other's first love. They help shape who the other one's going to become, and it's a beautiful relationship. I really like that.
That's sort of what I was thinking about this relationship, is that it is almost like people who are dating, except for the things that the things that people talk about when they're dating, like when do we have sex or when do we start having sex. There, instead of having sex, the discussion revolves around when do we start telling people that we've had sex, and even up to other certain moments, it felt like, you know, it felt like very real, like. Maybe they weren't dating in the traditional sense, but everything else about that relationship was like dating and everything. I thought it was an interesting dynamic.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, you know, it's obviously it's based on a lie, but a hugely honest relationship, and the most honest relationship either of them has ever had, because they can actually be themselves with each other. I really love that. I mean, I always see this film in a way as a romantic comedy. You know, it is. You know, it is this big romantic comedy between these two kids. They just, you know, they just don't fancy each other.
Yeah, yeah. How did you come about casting for this? There's you know, you have two dynamic leads here: Fiona O'Shea, Lola Pettigrew, and a wonderful supporting cast in this. So, how did you come along with finding these people?
I mean, it was a big. You know, all my anxiety with this film was kind of wrapped in finding the right Eddie and Amber. I think, you know, the film really hangs on their shoulders, and I felt like if they weren't right, or if you didn't believe their chemistry, the film just wouldn't work. So we did a really long casting to find the right Eddie and Amber, and, you know, we got hundreds of self-tapes, and Lola and Fionn both self-taped, and they were amazing. But then we did a chemistry read between the kind of top four boys and four girls, and brought them in twos, and just saw all these different pairings and saw which was the right one. And once we saw Lola and Fionn together, it was like, it was really lightning in a bottle. They were just extraordinary. And then we just had a really long, like 6 months of kind of rehearsal, which was just a way for me to make sure they were becoming friends. But like, they really quickly became best friends. I mean, I remember I was scouting for a location with my DP, Rory, and we bumped into Fiona and Lola on the streets of Dublin drinking wine from a sippy cup. And I was like, these are friends now. We did our job. So, yeah, like they even spent lockdown together. Like they're literally inseparable. They, you know, they FaceTime like 4 times a day. It's just, they're just best buds, and that's lovely. But like you said, the surrounding cast is amazing. I mean, I think obviously most known in the US would be Sharon Horgan, who's basically his mother, and she's just brilliant. And I really wrote this role for her, and I think she came on board extremely early. I don't know how. I think I just about finished the first draft, and my agent sent it to her agent. Then a week later, I was having coffee with Sharon in Soho in London, going, "What the heck happened here?" Like,
yeah,
she was amazing, and she's so funny, but also so emotional. I think she's really playing my mother in the film, and she, some of the scenes just really cut straight to the heart. But yeah, she's brilliant. And, you know, the dad, Barry Ward, and all the other kids are just hilarious. I mean, they have their own spin-off. They're so funny.
I would like to see a Kev movie if you can work that out.
Absolutely, let's start that campaign right now.
I have to say about the kids too, I really like these characters, because they're not like really, none of them are really bad kids, they're just kids, right? Like Kev is kind of like, he would be, if you compared him to like, you know, one of these comedies in America, he'd probably be like the Stifler, but like he's not a jerk, he's just kind of ignorant, I guess, would be the best way to put it.
Exactly. I mean, I think that's how I see it. I didn't want any kind of straightforward antagonist, because I very often think we see these kind of persecuting figures who are really anti-gay or horrible. And very often the things that hurt you most is just what people think is harmless bullying, but it's actually very, very damaging. And I don't think, you know, Kev or the other kids in the film ever really know the hurt they're causing. And, you know, I like to think in a few years' time, Kev would grow up to be this really lovely, informed, enlightened man. But right now, he's just an arsehole teenager. And he himself has got his own insecurities and issues. And, I just didn't want some sort of stereotypical cliched bully or kind of cliched military father, because I don't think they're not my experience, at least, and they're not true to my life. And I think that's very often what you most often see in these films. But I just think the truth is very often way more nuanced than that.
I'm so glad you talked about the father. The father is one of the most compelling characters in this. When you first meet him, he almost seems like Chris Cooper in American Beauty.
Yeah.
He almost seems very straightforward, demanding, and he's going to beat ass if he finds out that his son is gay or that he's failing at the physical requirements, things like that. And it's such a great performance because not only do you see his vulnerability in one scene in particular, but you also see his relationship with his son not being completely antagonistic. He even, you know, encourages him, you know, to go one way or another at one point. And I'm so glad you said that because it's such a complete view of a character that's not a caricature.
Yeah.
And that's refreshing to see.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of that's because Barry Ward, who plays Ian the Dad, is an amazing actor. He's such a brilliant guy. But yeah, I mean, I think we're so often used to these quite one-note military dads. And my dad was in the army, and I think I would have had a lot of fear when I was a kid about what he would think of me. But actually, the reality is he's the most loving, kind person. And, you know, sometimes people have difficulty knowing how to communicate the right things. But that doesn't mean that heart is in the right place. And I think that's very much so Barry's character, the dad, is that he doesn't always say the right things, but he means the right things. And he himself is struggling with things that his dad did to him in being quite kind of an angry military kind of person. So, yeah, I wanted to make sure that, you know, the audience are quite clear that if Eddie did, you know, come out, his parents would be fine with it. They'd be really loving, but it's his own inner demons that are holding him back. It's not those people around him. He's his own antagonist, and you know the people around him are just navigating the world and trying to make the best of it in the best way they can, and have their own baggage and issues. Barry's.
Yeah, yeah, and even God, I love scenes like this where it's almost anxiety producing to watch this movie. And I mean that in a good way, because you're channeling Eddie's anxiety. There's a moment, I don't want to spoil anything, but there's a moment where his mom absolutely knows. And she's just asking him to level with her and he can't do it. You're right. He's his own antagonist. He gets in his own way. He can't do it. And it's frustrating. But then you think about his frustration. You know, if I'm frustrated as a viewer, how frustrated is this guy, you know?
No, I mean, that scene, I mean, Sharon is so brilliant in that scene, as is Fionn. But that scene's one of those scenes that is very much so based on a real situation with my mum. And I think it really speaks to a lot of parents to gay kids, where, you know, they might have a hint, or they might know, but they don't know how to, I guess, broach it with their child. And I think there's that big fear of, you have to let the kid or the adult or whoever come out in their own way, in their own time. And you don't want to like say you're gay, because that can be really damaging. So it's just, you know, it's this mother in the 90s trying to be really loving and supportive, but not knowing what the best thing to do is. And I just think that's really, it speaks really truthfully, I think, to my parents and most parents of queer kids, you know, who are trying to do the best. But again, they just don't know what the best thing is. And it's a hard situation to navigate. But yeah, I think that's one of the scenes that always makes me tear up, just because it's so kind of true to my own life.
Oh, can I tell you, it's the last thing I'll say, I'm sorry, but I cried like a baby at the end of this movie. I absolutely cried my eyeballs out.
I wanted you to cry.
Oh my God. I knew it. As soon as I was doing it, I was like, oh yeah, he wants this.
Yeah, that's
and true. God, I just couldn't help myself.
And no, it is like, it's, you know, it's a hopeful ending without giving it away, but it is. It's, you know, it's about, like, going back to what I was saying about it being a romantic comedy, and it's a big tear-jerking romance in a way. And you know, you're letting go to let somebody move on. And
I'm getting teared up right now. Stop it.
That day was really special on set, just watching Fionn and Lola do those scenes. They're just so good. You know, when you have when you have a cast like that, you kind of just point the cameras and watch it happen. It's amazing.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Our bodies come in different shapes and sizes, so doesn't it make sense that our weight loss plans should too? That's the beauty of Noom. They build a personal plan that factors in dietary restrictions, medical issues, and other personal needs so your plan works for you. Noom doesn't restrict or shame when you want to treat yourself. Their flexible program focuses on progress instead of perfection. You don't have to give up carbs or anything. And with their daily lessons, you can learn something new about your food choices every day. After just a few days of using the app, I learned how to recognize cues for overeating and how to choose the right foods to feel full. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
I really like the period detail, by the way, in this too. 1995 was the year I graduated high school. Some things in there that were fun. There's references to both Oasis and Blur in this, in this. And so I'm wondering, for the record, who were you on? Whose side were you on?
In Blur. Blur, always Blur. It's only Blur. They're better musicians, less laddie, you know, less macho, kind of just generally better. And like, I was a really big Blur fan and a really big.
This is the correct answer. This is the correct answer.
The guys who liked Oasis were the guys who scared me. So.
the reference to zines, which I didn't think I'd ever hear that word ever again, that was something that was amazing. Just the casual reference to like anarchy and stuff like that. Those were very, very true to my high school experiences.
I kind of grew up in the tail end of zines, but I love that Lola wants to, you know, set up a zine and like. An anarchist book with franchise potential, which is such a ridiculous.
and of course, she gets asked, like, you know, can you make money doing that? And she's like, oh yeah, loads of money, you know.
But I mean, I think that's just being. I mean, even now, I'm sure it's with different things like YouTube channels. But that you're just a delusional child, and you know, I'm really fond of teenage pretension because I was a very pretentious teenager, and I love that you know, there's a real idiocy with it, even though I think you know it can create the foundation of really smart, brilliant, informed people. But I like that she's really like pretentious. Because I think teenagers are brilliant when they're pretentious. You know, we all were, and it's amazing. You know, I wanted her to be as pretentious as they come, but in the most loving way.
there's a scene at the beginning of this where there, you know, he's riding on his bike and he goes in. Doesn't notice that he's going into an open firing range. Yeah. Is that something that you can do?
That happened to me. So I grew up. that town that the film is set in, it's called Currabank Barracks, and I grew up there. And it is actually it's an active military town. So you know you're always like around tanks and soldiers and firing ranges, and then there's
points where
you're not allowed to go through the firing ranges. But yeah, frequently you would cycle not realizing there's live ammo kind of warning signs and stuff. And I don't know how I made it through alive, to be honest. That's definitely one that's true to life. Yeah, and it's a weird environment because it's a normal like little town like you would have in America or Ireland or anywhere, but you're just surrounded by guns. Well, actually, sorry, not so abnormal for America, but in Ireland, yeah. Unusual. So yeah, it's a really weird place, and I just love it. It's like it's a really beautiful kind of 18th or kind of 20th century red brick, kind of turn into 20th century red brick town. It's kind of like a Wes Anderson town come to life. It's like, you know, it's like a toy town. And I just love it. And I've always wanted to bring it to the screen. So it's been a big, long ambition of mine to bring the Curra to cinema.
Well, I'll tell you, I have never wanted to go somewhere more after watching a movie than this. Those hills that they run up on and just, you know, look over the pastures and everything. God, I mean, it's a tourism commercial for that part of Ireland. It's gorgeous.
I feel like I need to be paid by the tourism board.
Right.
But it's a weird place because, you know, it's really beautiful. And, you know, you grew up not realizing how beautiful it is until you kind of go away. But it's one of those places, it's kind of bypassed by the roads. So it's one of those places in Ireland you drive by without ever going through. So it's kind of like a hidden treasure in Ireland itself. People don't really know how beautiful the Curra is, unless you're from Kildare like I am. So yeah, it's kind of nice just being able to show people how lovely it is, because it really is stunning. It's one of the biggest open plains in Europe. I think it might be the second biggest.
Wow.
And it's just stunning. And, you know, it's covered in sheep shit, but it's stunning.
I'm sorry that I did not, was not able to, find this, before asking you, but, who plays his brother? Who plays Eddie's brother in this?
Oh, he's an absolute icon. His brother's played by Evan O'Connor, this is his very first role. He's only like 13.
Oh my God, he's so funny in this.
So funny. He's gonna get snapped up by some like Judd Apatow or somebody. Like, he's so funny, and he ad libs unlike anybody I've ever seen. Like, you're watching him just ad lib with Sharon Horgan going, "What the hell is going on?" It's amazing.
Timing is perfect.
Oh, his timing. Oh. The minute I think after Eddie and Amber, that was the hardest role to cast, because you're essentially having a young kid talk about things like fingering, which could be which could be really gross if it's not in the right hands, but his comedy timing is so funny. We would break the sets would just break out in laughter very often after the take. He was just, and he's not this is his first role. I think he'll go into a very big career, but he's such an on-phase kid. He just comes in going, "What's that? Oh, it's a Nintendo. What's a Nintendo? Oh, okay." And then and then leaves. And like, he's just so on-phase by everything and so brilliant. I kind of want to do an outtake because his outtakes are the best.
Probably my favorite scene of this movie. There's a lot of great scenes, but my favorite scene of this movie has got to be when Eddie and Amber go to their room and go to his room and his mom's like, "Keep the door open." And then he immediately follows by saying, "Oh, well, they haven't had sex yet." And she's like, "Jesus Christ." And then he's like, "Oh, all he's done is fingered her." It's just so matter of fact and everything.
He is genuinely one of the funniest finds I think ever. All his scenes are brilliant. I just think
that's a moment that works a couple different ways too, because I mean, it is really funny, but also that does actually make sense. I mean, a lot, you know, he's just one of those kids that's like, doesn't understand these adult things, but you know, feels like he does. It felt like he would actually say something like that in that moment. I also liked the little running bit where he kept letting his brother know that people were talking about him, and he would try to like soften it, but then he would actually make it worse. You know, he was like, well actually it is everybody, you know.
Like, he really is just brilliant. He's just so good. I'm kind of in awe. And he's kind of, I always, in the script even, I think that character, Jack, the younger brother, he's kind of like the Greek chorus in the film. He's kind of just could matter-of-factly say things, like, you know, in a very funny way. Like, you know, everyone else has these kind of nuanced kind of arcs, and he's just there to say it really bluntly, and I just love that.
Yeah, I get the sense that, you know, in a few years, people are going to find this movie if they hadn't previously and go, wow, look at all the people that are in this movie.
Yeah. I mean, I do think we have the cream of the crop when it comes to young Irish actors. And just think, you know, whether it be Evan who plays Jack or Ian O'Reilly who plays Kev, or, you know, the girls, Emma and Anastasia who play Janet and Tracy, they're so funny and so mm-hmm. good.
Yeah.
I think they all have really bright futures ahead of them. But, you know, we just got so lucky, because I think with a comedy, you need every role to work, or sometimes you'll have a dud scene. And in this, we just had, like, even our extras were funny. Like, you know, there's a scene in the cinema where you have a bunch of extras giving handjobs to your friend. You know, that they just were committed extras. They just went. And I was, you know, and that only works if you have good background actors. And you don't, very often you can't get that many. And we just got really lucky.
Can I ask you about the brothel? The sex caravan
what you were talking about there.
Yeah. I mean, that's just such a it's almost just assumed. Nobody really questions it. Nobody really asks if this is the right thing to do. She just says this is a place for horny teenagers to go, yeah. And she's profiting off of it.
Yeah.
And it's just absolutely like, well, it seems like her mom even kind of knows about it. But like, it's how does that factor into your script when you're writing this? Like, you know what? Let's put a sex caravan in there, yeah, too.
I just think, you know, if we're going to talk about modern cinema, I think it's the tragic lack of sex caravans that's really dragging it. I kind of love that she has this escape plan. You know, she's making money to leave. And yeah. You know, she's got access to these caravans. She's got access to lots of horny teenagers that need to have sex to make some money. And I love that Amber is, even though she wants to be a punk, she'll grow up to be a brilliant businesswoman. Like, she's just got a capitalist streak, and it's manifested very early. But you know, that, like, I mean, I didn't have a sex caravan, but, you know, kids are horny and they'll do it anywhere. And, you know, it just makes fun. It was good.
It's funny because for a comedy that's so focused on sex, there's very little sex shown.
Very little sex shown.
Except for one very, I don't like this word, but tender moment. With Amber and the girl she meets, and it goes to show that you don't have to go there in order to show a coming of age, especially a sexual coming of age, for people. That scene with Eddie on stage, just coming to terms with a part of himself, is every bit as effective as a raunchy sex scene in an otherwise lesser comedy.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I wanted to make sure that we weren't shying away from sex, and that, you know, if you're going to have a film in which the two central characters are, you know, a lesbian and a gay guy, you want to make sure that you give them the opportunity to explore that side of themselves. And I think we give that to both the characters. But then, you know, and I think that, you know, I think, as you mentioned, you know, there's really tender sexual moments in this, and I think it should be. But then, you know, sex, particularly when you're that age, is also just really bad and funny. And, I think I'm pretty sure I could be in the Guinness Book of Records for the amount of hand jobs I've now directed. I think all those things, you know, sex at that age is, you know, it's eye-opening, it's really tender and sweet, it can be really frightening as it is sometimes in the film, it can be really funny, and just ridiculous as it is in the film, and I think you want to show that kind of breadth of experience. And you know, like, I don't want to direct a porno, so it's never going to get too explicit with it, but, right. You know, it is that thing, you don't want to shy away from it, but, you know, it's not the focus of the film. But, yeah.
The movie theater scene, though, where... They're just just them in the foreground, just like eating popcorn, watching the movie while all that's going on. Though is just it's brilliant.
It was so much fun, and then it's like the most. It's the saddest film they're watching. I think the film they're watching is about a person dying of cancer, and it's just like it's inappropriate. Inappropriate film to be having a hand job, but yeah. That's what happened in that cinema back then. Tragically, I was never cool enough, but teenagers just go to the cinema to do that stuff. And that's just, it's true to life as well as being really funny. It was the most weird day on set. So I was like with my AD going, how do I direct this? Like, how do I direct these guys to do that? Like, what do I do? But it was great. It was fun.
I know that this is mostly autobiographical. Well, not mostly autobiographical. It's based on real things and whatnot. But did you feel any pressure when you were writing this to give Eddie any kind of love interest? Because I think a lot of times these movies try to find their way to their happy ending through a love interest of some sort, and I found it refreshing that it didn't do that.
Yeah, I think his, I think his journey is about coming to terms with who he is and kind of going, without giving it away. It's self acceptance, and you don't find that in somebody else, And I think, when you do first come out, you're very often not yet in that place to be with somebody else. It just, you can be lucky, but it's very rare. First you come out and then you go find somebody or, find yourself. And so that was never really, just because it is so honest to life and, that that didn't happen to me. So, I think for me, that wasn't his journey. I mean, he has a really sweet moment. He has probably the best first kiss in a gay club and great moments, but it wasn't about, for him, that wasn't his journey. It's a love story between him and Amber, and I wanted to keep that the focus. So, it's very much so about these two kids, I didn't want to give him a boyfriend at the end because I think that would have, I think you mentioned, but it would have just felt expected. It kind of feels like that's what happens, and it's not the story I was telling.
Yeah, if this movie was made here, that's exactly what would have happened. I have a feeling, and it just doesn't, you're right, it doesn't seem true to life really. If that's the case, but
wait for the bastardized remake, they can do it in there.
yeah exactly. Guys, do you have anything else to ask?
I did want to ask you real quick, if you don't mind, the movie you did before this, The Cured, which, even though that's about zombies, there's a lot of similar themes here.
I mean, absolutely. I mean, that's, it's kind of a horror drama about, cured zombies. But I mean, for me, that film was all about struggling with your inner monster. And I made it at a time I wasn't as at peace with myself, so it feels like it's the other side of the coin to dating Amber. It's kind of, it was at a point when I was a very angry, frustrated man. And now I hope a more enlightened man. I can make the conversion. But yeah, I think it's, it's definitely a similar themes. I think, I don't know if, it's funny because Dating Amber, which originally was called Beards, was, I wrote it quite a long time ago, and there was a time that it actually could have been my first film, but just, financing happens in different ways. And but once I made The Cured, I went straight back to try get financing for Dating Amber because it was such a passion project of mine. But I was thinking recently, had I had the opportunity to make it first, would it be as good? Would it be as funny? I don't know if I had the distance yet to tell that story. I think there's that thing of, tragedy plus time equals comedy, and I just think I don't think I had enough time yet to make that film as well as I wanted to make. So I'm kind of quite grateful it wasn't my first feature, because I think it's much better now that I have had all that.
Yeah,
and also you learn so much on your first film. You kind of learn a lot of lessons that you bring to your second film. So yeah, so I'm kind of glad that things worked out.
I just remember when that came out, that was, there was obviously a lot of zombie movies coming out and TV shows and whatnot. And I remember keep thinking, I wish somebody would do one about, if they actually got cured, because I just had kind of this moment in my mind, people that were around them would be like, I get that you couldn't help what you were doing, but you still ate my mom.
Yeah.
And I, you know, I can't forgive you for that. That kind of, that kind of thing. And I know this is more of a drama, but I just, it was just, it was a really cool movie.
Yeah.
A really cool take on the zombie subgenre.
Yeah. So. No, I'm really proud of it. I mean, it was a fun one to make. It was really good to make. I mean, you know, there's always chatter about revisiting it in TV or something, but it was great. But I think it's, you know, if I was going back to make it now, I'd put a few more jokes in it just because. If you're going to be honest about life, you're going to have humor in it. It doesn't matter how tragic things are. There's always humor. And I think, you know, I think going forward in my career, even if it's quite dark material, I think there'll be a bit more humor in them just because I like doing humor.
I was just going to ask if there was any particular day where there was some, like the hardest shooting day that you had. What was the biggest challenge that you had when you were shooting this?
I mean, we got so lucky with this. We had a very tight 5-week shoot. So it was very tight, like 24 or 5 days shooting. But we worked, because we rehearsed so much with the actors, we managed to get through scenes really quickly and had time to play as well. So everything ran really smoothly. I think the only day we had real difficulty was I wrote Amber Drives and Lola Cannot Drive. So we had to get...
No.
Yeah, so we had to get like a low loader, but the low loader we got, because we had no money, well, we had money, we had very little, it couldn't reverse. So we kept having to drive around this massive kind of estate for every time she went by. Like, it was the simplest scene, but we ended up eating up time and time. So we had to lose one scene, which was a dinner scene where the mother kind of looks kind of sadly at her son, knowing kind of what he's going through. We had to scrap it. So at the end of the day, we were losing life. We're like, quick, Fionn, just run over to the swing and look really depressed. And we you know, you want to give every scene time, and you try not to give your actors an emotion, which, you know, you try, but sometimes you just have to shout and they go, just look sad. but we had such a fun, like, genuinely every single day on that film was a holiday. It was so much fun. Again, because we had a great cast, great crew, and, you know, it really did. I say my next film is going to be an absolute nightmare because I took all my luck in that one.
It translates, though. I found myself genuinely loving this movie, even though, because of all the things that you've said, it's emotional, but it's sometimes it's just laugh out loud funny.
Yeah.
And it's so true to life and the characters are so enmeshed. You could tell that joy that you guys had translates through the screen just delightfully. So yeah, bravo.
Thank you. Yeah, no, we had so much fun. I think we're all really proud of it. I think you know, and it's been really nice because it came out in the UK earlier, like in May, it came out. And we just keep, even daily now, we're still getting fan art and fan videos and like let messages. It's just really hit a chord with, surprisingly for me, I think, you know, I expected people of my age and your age going, oh, I remember the 90s, nostalgia, great. But we're actually getting loads of kids just going how much they've loved it and responded to it and how much it's kind of, how much they resonate with Fionn and Lola's characters. And that's not something I was expecting, and it's been a really lovely thing to have. Kind of, it's been quite cheering during this pandemic of ours.
Well, Americans are gonna love it too. And this is getting released on VOD and digital. And do you know any theaters or anything like that?
It's doing some kind of virtual theaters, I think. But yeah, because of the goddamn COVID thing, even bothered me. I think it's kind of, yeah, straight digital and VOD, but which is great. People can enjoy it in the comfort.
They can. Yeah, I do want to know. Do you know what you're doing next? Are you working on anything? Currently?
Yeah. No. Absolutely. So I have a few TV projects in development that I'm really excited about, but I can't announce. I've written another 2 feature scripts, one of them that we're hoping to shoot early next year called Epping, that is It's a revenge comedy about a guy who tries to kill this other guy for killing his partner. But when he gets him back to his house, he can't go through it. So they end up having to live together. it's an absurdist revenge comedy, which I'm hoping to shoot next year. And then, yeah, a few other really exciting things. And I've just been kind of writing my way through this lockdown. So, it's been quite nice.
I can't wait. And when the next one comes out, can you come on and talk to us again?
I would love to. Yeah, I would absolutely love that.
All right. We love you. So come back on.
We would like to thank David Frayne for giving us his time. This was wonderful. Your movie, Dating Amber, is wonderful. It comes out on November 10th. It's an on-demand and digital. That's going to do it for this interview. It's Chris Atkinson, Barrett Sher, and Jonathan Watkins. We'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening. Comment on our episodes on our SoundCloud page. Check us out on YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, and Reddit. And be sure to visit CinemaSins.com.